This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for KnowHow is brought to you by CashFly.
This episode of KnowHow is brought to you by Joby. Joby's GorillaPod is the signature flexible tripod amongst leading photographers and journalists. Currently, Joby is transitioning to a new production center and isn't accepting orders. However, leave your email with them for an update on product availability, and when they're back, receive 15% off your first order. Go to Joby.com and enter TWIT at checkout. And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com/knowhow to save 20% off any order. Today on KnowHow,
it's your questions, our answers.
Welcome to KnowHow. It's a Twitch show where we build, bend, break, and occasionally upgrade. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire.
And I'm Patrick Delahan.
And for the next however many minutes it takes, we're going to be dropping knowledge into the ear holes to get into the brain pit thing.
That stuff.
That's all that, yeah. No, but we wanted to do a full-on feedback episode. It's been a while. We've done little bits and pieces, but y'all come up with some really good questions in the KnowHow group, and we kind of wanted to throw some love back.
Yeah. We picked out some really good questions, and we'll try to help you out here.
Yeah. Now, the first one is, I'm going to say this is a consequence of some of the networking episodes that we do. Mm. We always try to tell people that this is knowledge, and knowledge is good, and knowledge gives you information that
knowledge
you can maybe
power.
Use a little bit later. However, you have to be careful, because sometimes a little knowledge freaks you the heck out.
Yeah, I've
seen this before, where we tell people how to port scan, we tell people how to look for vulnerabilities, and they find something, and it's just like, I'm being hacked, folks.
Yeah.
relax. We're going to show you how to increase your chill with just a little bit of port knowledge. Now, Patrick, you and I, we're both networking people, so you play with ports and services all the time.
Yeah, I know all about port 25 and all the other cool ports.
Precisely, because that's how you open up a computer, a server, a client, whatever, so that it can serve out information or so that it can respond to a request. Now, in the past episodes, we've done the disclaimer of shut down any ports that you don't need, and that's typically good advice.
It could be dangerous because you could be shutting down some ports you actually do need, you just don't know about.
Or in this particular case, we have a user who scanned his network, which, very good. Good on you. Thank you very much for doing that. The more people that do that, the more secure the internet's going to be. But he's having a little mini freak out on some ports that he found open. Now, Patrick, what do we got?
We've got ports. Well, this is from Patrick Sheiky.
Sheiky, yeah.
He says, I have some open ports on my PC to Microsoft. Should I close them? There are 135 TCP, which is Microsoft Windows RPC, 139 TCP, Microsoft Windows NetBIOS SSN, and 445 TCP Microsoft DS Windows 10 Home.
Now, Patrick, some people are going to read this and they're going to go, wait, why does he keep putting TCP? Isn't a port a port? But we know that that's not how it actually works.
Yeah, it could be TCP, it could be UDP, it could be used for...
Right. Yeah. Now, the two protocols that you see most often are TCP, Transport Control Protocol, and UDP, which is Unified Datagram Protocol,
something? I don't remember.
Yeah, I just call it UDP.
Yeah, it's TCP UDP.
But in this particular case, it's he's listing TCP because when he ran the Nmap, it said TCP port is open. But most likely, it's also TCP UDP. In this particular case... Mr. Sheiky, don't freak out. This is perfectly normal. 135 is typically used for Microsoft remote procedure calls. You're going to be seeing it called RPC. This is just the standard way that a Windows client will use a client-server app. So if you use Exchange, if you use a VPN, that has to be open. Otherwise, that doesn't work. You mentioned this earlier. If you close that down... Yeah, it's more secure, but you've just gotten rid of a lot of really useful stuff.
Yeah, you've cut off your access to whatever needs to use that port.
Yeah.
And it could be important things, updates.
Don't do that.
The other one is 136. This is NetBIOS. Now, if you've heard the name NetBIOS, there's a good reason for that. It's actually very common. It's very popular. It allows it's a protocol for file and print sharing. In fact, it's a really old protocol for file print and print sharing. I tend to turn it off on the networks that I have total control over, because there are much more useful, much more advanced protocols that I can use now. However, if you run a legacy network or a hybrid network where you've got more advanced equipment and older equipment, then you might still see NetBIOS turned on. Yeah.
Right.
Do you have NetBIOS in your network?
I have a Mac network. So,
yeah, so hell no. hell's to the no.
I don't know, though. My wife has a Windows machine. I don't know. I haven't scanned my ports. I should really do that.
Now, the other one is 445 TCP. Oh, this absolutely do not disable. If you've got Windows, if you turn off 445, you basically just kneecapped yourself, because that is for SMB. That's server message block. This is a protocol for file sharing. In fact, it's the protocol for file sharing. If you ever put // and then the name of the server, that's using Samba, SMB. If you turn that off, it just means that you won't be able to use the fastest and simplest way for you to transfer files across your network.
Now, what if he's not transferring files? What if there's just the, you know, him and his one computer, he doesn't share anything?
Yeah, and I will say this. If you are intending your computer to be a standalone, in other words, it ain't connecting to nothing. It's just a workstation. In fact, maybe you don't even have it connected to the internet. It's only connected to an internal network. Then, okay, go ahead and shut off these ports. But you lose a lot of utility. Now, you may have heard that there was a vulnerability in Samba version 1. There's been vulnerabilities in NetBIOS, and there have been a lot of exploits over RPC. That's all true. I don't want to take that away. So you should still be aware of that. However, that's only going to happen if you actually have those ports exposed to what we call an attack surface. Inside a network, if it's your network and it's just you, that's not really an attack surface, unless you're attacking yourself or unless you bring a compromised device into your network. However, if for some reason these ports are accessible on the router, that's a problem, because that is a huge attack surface. That's the internet. Yeah. The internet can now attack you. So if you're going to be using Nmap, what you want to do is go ahead and run a port scan on the inside, just so you can turn off any of those other ports that you don't really need. However, the real test is to run an Nmap test or a Shields Up test, if you go to grc.com, against your WAN address, your internet address, because that's what the world's actually going to see. So again, good on you. Very good for this for you to seek out this information, but no need to freak out just yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, those seem fine.
Yeah. So. Let's go and go into another one also on network testing. We've got Brian Ward who, he's got a little question about network testing.
Brian writes, does anyone have a good suggestion on how to test a network jack is live and getting DHCP without plugging it in a computer? Sometimes I need to verify several jacks in different locations, but do not want to carry around my laptop. I was wondering if there is a way to use an Arduino with the Ethernet shield and maybe display to show the IP address, also needing it to run off a battery.
Brian, I love where you're going with this. Yes. You want to make a portable network tester. Now, the one that you've seen me use a couple of times on the show, in fact, Brian still has my favorite one. Hopefully I get that back at some point, is a Fluke Net tool. I've had these forever. And the cool thing about these is they're basically self-contained units.
Yeah.
In one device, I've got a cable tester, I've got a continuity tester, and I can also do DHCP and ping testing. In other words, I plug this in, and it's kind of a one-stop shop. I hit the go button, and it will tell me, do I have an IP address? It will tell me, is the cable properly connected? And it will even tell me if I can ping out. Like, I can set ping Google and Microsoft and Amazon when I hit the test button. Super, super useful. And believe it or not, since these are like 20 years old, they're not that expensive. If you go ahead and go to that that link there for a Fluke Net tool, it's an eBay link. You're not going to buy these new, again, because they're 20 years old, but you can find them for as low as $140. In fact, I've seen them go down to like $85 if it's not in great cosmetic condition.
Yeah, those are just the featured options at the top.
Precisely. So yeah,
some good deals in there.
These things are bulletproof. They work really well, and they're powered off of batteries. Actually, if you go to the overhead cam here, Burke, you can see why this one's not working. Whoops. If you leave batteries in too long, they tend to turn into magic dust.
Womp, womp.
Womp, womp. That kind of leaked all over the PCB, and I can still fix it, but yeah. I'm lazy. And besides, the other one still works, so hey, cranky hippo, could I get my net tool back? I really like that.
He's busy analyzing the networks.
That's right. So. Well, because I sent him home with it because I wanted him to learn how to properly terminate Category 5 cable.
Well, it's good knowledge to have.
It is. All right. Now, the other part of the question, and this is fantastic, is he wanted to know if he could make his own tester. I mean, that's $85 to $150. Can you make something less expensive that does the same thing? And the answer is kind of.
How much effort would that take, though?
It's not that much effort, but the problem is the results may not be super, super happy. Now, you've all seen this before. This is the little test stand that I make whenever I'm just prototyping stuff. If you go ahead and go to the side view there, Burke, as you can see, it's got a 2004 LCD screen. So this is 4 lines by 20 characters. It's got an Arduino Uno, and then it's got an Ethernet shield. Now, this does work. In fact, you can use a piece of code that's built into the Sketch IDE called Server. If you go to the Ethernet drop-down menu, and it will allow you to create a program that will display on the 2004 an IP address, which is exactly what he wanted for. And we all know how this is very easy to battery power. You just give it 5 volts from any power source, and you can make this a portable unit. A little problem, though, Patrick, and that is it's kind of iffy.
It's not that reliable?
Super. In fact, if you go ahead and go to the side view, Burke, right now this should be displaying a IP address. And
there's nothing.
It's totes not. This was working just a couple of minutes ago, and on this particular one, it just decided that it didn't want to go anymore. Reason for this is because either the shield or the library, we're still trying to figure out what it is, doesn't always play well with switches. So the switches that we have in this building, the switches that we have on this network, at some point, this just decided that it doesn't want to communicate anymore.
Yeah, it'd be pretty frustrating to go around testing your network and then suddenly a port comes up and there's nothing.
Yeah.
And you realize it's not the port's problem, it's this.
Yeah, exactly. So. I mean, this is sort of the defining thing about a test, a piece of test gear, and that is it has to work 100% of the time. Because you have a piece of test gear so you can test the network. Well, if the problem is with the test gear, then suddenly you think there's a problem with the network where there's not actually a problem with the network. That's not so much bueno. What I would suggest is perhaps getting something a little higher powered. Some of the ESPs, the higher-end embedded controllers that also do include Ethernet, might be a better go. Those are more tightly integrated. Those libraries work a tiny bit better. I'm actually going to experiment with this because I already know how to make it work, and I know the package I can make it work in. I just need to find the right controller so that I'm not always messing around. Yeah, you like it, right?
Well, I'm thinking if he has to test enough that it's a pain to have to carry a laptop everywhere, that this is probably the better way to go.
Yeah, nice, exactly.
Compact, and obviously this has been around a long time, long enough that the batteries have leaked.
Yeah, so. Precisely. And here's the thing. If you look at price, you're looking at, $5 for the screen. You're looking at $10 to $15 for the shield. You're looking at another $5 to $20 for the Uno, depending on if you buy a clone or a generic. Printing a case.
Yeah.
Or in this particular case, getting like an ESP that will work better than this Uno. And then you have a tool that's going to cost you maybe $50, so
yeah,
$35.
Plus time to put it together.
Plus time. I mean, don't let that dissuade you.
Yeah.
If you want to create one, that's awesome. Just know that something like this, even used, is probably going to be a much, much better buy.
Yeah, that sounds, I would go with that.
Yeah. All right, now when we come back, you know what we want to do, Patrick?
What?
I want to play with water.
Oh, just going to throw water on the whole thing?
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, yeah. That's how you do. Yeah. But before we get there, hey, folks, guess what? We've got a brand new sponsor to the show. Now, I know that a lot of you are into photography. A lot of you like to make sure that you've got the proper equipment when you travel so you can get that perfect shot. A lot of you always walk around with tripods or those, oh, God forbid, selfie sticks. Folks, if you want to up your photography game, if you want to make sure that you can always capture just the shot that you want, then there's really only one company that you should be thinking about. And that's Joby. Now, this episode of Know How is brought to you by Joby. In 2006, Joby revolutionized creativity with the first ever flexible tripod. That's right, the GorillaPod. You may remember that. It's the little device that allowed it to sort of hug and grab and hold on to basically anything. You could attach it to a bleacher. You could attach it to a chair. You could attach it to a friend. It was a tripod that just worked better. It was a stainless steel reinforced ball head with a 90-degree tilt, perfect for shooting in landscape or portrait mode. Now, the GorillaPod's flexible legs would wrap around objects for unlimited angles and precise composition control. It also had rubberized rings and foot grips to provide stability on uneven surfaces for crisp, clear photos. Now, how do we know that this design was awesome? Because everybody tried to copy it. Everyone wanted a bite on Joby's style, but they just couldn't get that secret sauce quite like the original. Now, you can mount a variety of devices, including point and shoot, action, 360 mirrorless, and DSLR cameras. You can also mount flashes, video lights, or any device with a 1/4-inch to 20 standard tripod mount. Joby's flexible, stable, and versatile, and it's the perfect piece of kit for your next trip when you want to take those great photos. Folks, grip it, wrap it, stand it. Whatever you want to do, you can see the full line at Joby.com. Currently, Joby is transitioning to a new production center, and it isn't accepting online orders. That just means that it's going to be so much better once they get the new factory up and running. Check back soon, or you can leave your email with them for an update on product availability. And once they are accepting online orders, enter TWIT at checkout to receive 15% off. That's Joby.com, and soon you can enter TWIT at checkout for 15% off your order. Never miss the perfect photo again with Joby. All right, Patrick. So we've got one of these questions that's going to involve electricity and water.
How could this go wrong?
I don't see how that possibly could go wrong. Oh, but we're going to have to do a little bit of math. Got a question here from Hector Sotomayor. And what does Hector need?
Hector says, I have a 7-amp DC water pump in my food trailer that killed my car battery. Can you show me how to run it off our electric source instead of the battery source? The pump will only be used when we turn on the water, which is maybe once or twice a day. The pump is protected from the weather and used to pump fresh water into the sink. Yes, I do have a power source right next to the pump.
Okay, so this is actually pretty typical. How do you get a water source into something like a food truck? And actually, Luckily, I've been doing research on this because...
You're going to have a food truck?
No, but I am going to have...
Tacos.
We're kind of doing something fun with a road trip type thing, and we're equipping my vehicle so that I can do it properly. And a water source, a running water source, is actually kind of useful.
Yeah.
Now, he's doing the typical traditional solution, which is to have some sort of water pump. And in his particular case, he said a 7-amp DC water pump, which I'm thinking if it's DC, it's probably a 7-amp 12-volt water pump. He's using that to pump water from a reservoir tank into like a sink or some sort of faucet that he's using to clean and cook. Now, he says that the pump is only going to be used a couple of times a day, so it's not going to want to be one of these constantly running things.
Right.
He does have an AC outlet, and I don't know if that means that he has like an extension cord to something or if he's got it plugged into the 12-volt system through a... some sort of accessory adapter.
My guess would be the 12-volt car
12-volt
battery.
Probably. Sort of, yeah. So let's do a little math. You know how I love doing some math. Again, it's probably DC. It's probably 12-volt. It probably requires 7 amps, but it probably requires 7 amps on startup. Now, you know this. All appliances, the startup power is sort of a surge. It needs more at startup than it does for continuous running. But the reason why we list that amount of power, that amount of amperage, is because if you design a circuit that can't handle that startup surge...
You can't start it.
You can't start it, and, yep. Or you could blow stuff up, which don't do that. That's bad. In this particular case, remember our formula, West Virginia. Watts equals volts times amps. That's probably the most useful formula that you can have. We know that we need to have the wattage rating of this thing. We know it's 12 volts. We know it's 7 amps. So we know that we're going to need 84 watts. Okay, that's what we're looking at. We need something that can provide this a peak of 84 watts in order for this pump to run properly. Now, we need to be able to safely provide those 84 watts. So what I would suggest is something like this. Burke, if you go ahead and go to that link, this is a 120-watt AC to DC power supply. Now, this is 12 volts, 10 amps. So this is actually more than he's going to require for that pump. And, of course, West Virginia, again, 12 volts times 10 amps equals 120 watts. It should be more than enough to power, even if they underrated the pump. Right. You know, we're giving him a good 30% headroom here, just in case the power supply either doesn't really support 120 watts, or in case the pump uses a bit more than 84.
Right.
Yeah, and that's always good. Throw yourself some headroom, because headroom keeps things from burning.
And if you need to power something else later on,
right,
you've got more options there.
Right, exactly. Whenever you buy equipment like this, it's always good to kind of plan for the future. You know, very, very good point, Patrick. Now, here's the thing. That's easy, and that's an easy fix, because that adapter is going to cost you, what, something like $20?
Yeah.
But what if you wanted something a little bit more non-traditional? And this is where my little road trip across the country comes into play.
Oh, what are you
I've
doing?
Been looking at bladder tanks.
Oh, my. Oh.
No, it's not what you think, Patrick. Oh, Mike, why do you always go to the worst-case scenario?
You're the one that brings me there.
This is a bladder tank.
Oh,
whew. I know.
Wait, where does that go?
So, Patrick, you want to turn to the side a little bit? No, bad Patrick. Okay, you've probably seen this if you have a reverse osmosis system in your house. What we see a lot is that when you use a reverse osmosis system, especially on a low pressure system, it really affects the amount of water that you get out. So you turn on the faucet, and rather than a run, it's a little dribble.
Yeah.
This allows me to store up water, specifically to store up water under pressure, and then turn it on so that I can inject a little bit of pressure back into the system. In fact, they call this a booster tank as well, in addition to a bladder tank. But the reason why we call it a bladder tank is if you go ahead and go to the front view, Burke, if you look at this, the bottom part of here is actually a bladder. It's an air-filled bladder. And then the top part is water. So this may be a 5-gallon tank, but it really holds about 3.7 gallons of water. It's all steel. The way that this works is, if you notice, there's only one way in and there's only one way out. And people might be scratching their head going, well, how do you get – that doesn't work. But if – and I've already depressurized this almost all the way. If I turn this little valve – oop. I live for those moments. By the way, this is clean water, so it's reverse osmosis.
Yeah, I knew that would end up in your body.
Yeah, right? That's kind of how it works here at KnowHow. No, but the cool thing about this is I can charge the tank. And it just uses these quarter-inch NPT, these nylon fittings. So it's super, super easy to run. And, I mean, this is incredibly flexible. But this can give me up to about 30 PSI of water pressure. That is a ton. I mean, this is that little spray that you saw, that's with the tank being empty. I emptied this thing entirely out when I was traveling last. Now, the way I control that is, actually, if you go to the side shot here, Burke, this little thing right here, that's actually, if I take this off, this is where I inject pressure. So that's just, it's just a little valve. It's the same kind of valve that you would put air into your tire. So I can inflate or deflate that bladder just by air pressure. And if I increase the amount of air pressure, it also increases the amount of water pressure. If I decrease the amount of air pressure, it decreases the amount of water pressure.
So this is a giant super soaker, essentially.
Yeah.
You put it in high pressure.
Precisely. But the pressure I need to generate to fill this tank, I can get it from anywhere. So I actually have a fitting on the other side of this that attaches to, like, the kind of adapter you have on a garden hose.
Right.
And all I would do is I would turn on the garden hose, open this up, and it would fill. And when I hear that what liquid is no longer flowing, then I know that it's at equilibrium. The amount of pressure in this tank is the amount of pressure coming out of that hose, and it's not going to fill anymore.
Yeah.
And then I just close my valves, close off the hose, disconnect, reconnect to my car system, and I'm good to go.
And about how long would this tank last, do you estimate, during your
well,
road trip?
Well, if this was a disaster time, you typically need 1 gallon of water per person per day. Yeah. And that's for everything. That's for hydrating. That's for hygiene. This will hold close to 4 gallons. So this is a four-day supply.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not bad. And, I mean, again, I'm not disastering myself. This is just so I have a little bit of water. I can I actually have adapted this to the solar shower. So I can take a nice little shower. I just pump a gallon of water up into the shower, and then it just gravity assist on to Padre.
But this is also something that would be handy for people that are in the areas that are being hit by hurricanes.
Yes,
now,
so. Actually, very much so, because the nice thing about this is it's a sealed unit. So
yeah.
You're not going to contaminate this water.
Yeah, even if it's submerged.
Yeah, even if it's submerged, you just like shake it off and then turn it on. And it's going to blow out anything that has gotten into the system.
And you get fresh water.
And you get fresh water.
Under pressure.
And I think I've got some links here. If you go to that first link, they're not that expensive. These are super, super inexpensive. This particular one, it's going to cost you like $40, but I've seen these go as low as $25.
Yeah.
And, you know, they work incredibly well. Now, a few things about this. If you're going to buy one of these, you want to buy a food grade.
Yes.
Because what will happen is if you let the water sit long enough, if it's not food grade, the chemicals from the bladder kind of leach back into the water.
And I think even if you're not planning to use it for drinking water, it's good to have that option later on.
Oh, yeah.
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 Especially if there's a hurricane coming your way. Oh, I've got this thing. I can use this now and drink it.
Yeah. I was able to get a full 5 gallons out of this total pain in the ass way. What you could do is you could deflate the bladder entirely, and the entire thing fills up with water, and then you use like a bicycle pump to slowly increase pressure. But yeah, it worked. It kind of defeats, you lose all the convenience of having the booster tank in the first place. However, for Hector, there is one huge advantage of using a booster tank, and they have these all the way up to 40 gallons. And that is when you have water in a tank, and that tank is in a vehicle, what tends to happen is it tends to slosh.
Yeah.
And like 40 gallons of water, that's a lot of weight.
Yeah, if that's in a trailer, then that's just making the trailer go all over the place and you lose control of the car.
Precisely, yeah. Just think of, remember when we were still doing those ice bucket challenges and you see all those fail videos of people not realizing how much water actually weighs.
It's actually really dense. Tumble with the...
Yeah, now imagine all of that water going to one side of the trailer and then to the other. And what happens is you get this horrible sympathetic resonance where it's, you know, as it's sloshing, it's making the car move. And as the car moves, it increases the sloshing. And it's just a horrible feedback loop and you lose control.
Yeah.
There's no sloshing with a bladder tank because there's no empty space.
It's bladder, all full of either water or air.
Precisely. As the bladder expands, there's no void created by the water leaving the tank. It's just the bladder just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
It stays under pressure.
Yeah.
Even if it's close to empty like this.
David Bowie would be proud. And for the people who don't get that, that just means you're not old enough.
Just move on.
Yeah, just move on. Move on. All right, let's go ahead and move on from water and electricity to talking about something that I love, and that is 3D printing. We've got here from Patrick. Okay, you got to help me with this because he's got the same first. Is it Bolo? I want to say like Bala. Bala? Like, I'm going to say Bala because Patrick Bala sounds Bala. Pat, what does Patrick need, Patrick?
On the advice of Padre and Brian, I purchased a Monoprice Maker Select V2. I've been mostly printing objects I find on Thingiverse, but I want to start creating my own projects like on KnowHow. I've been using Tinkercad, and while it's really easy to use, that can't be what Padre actually uses for his projects. If it is, then it means that I'm lacking some basic knowledge about designing 3D parts.
Patrick, I feel your pain. I totally understand this. I get this a lot because Tinkercad, it's very easy to get into, but people very quickly think they run into the upper limits of what it can do.
Right.
And this is all true. I mean, if you had a full-blown CAD program, you could do a whole lot more. You could do compound shapes. You could do these wonderful curves. But what I like about Tinkercad is, A, it's free. B, it's always available. As long as I have a browser, I have access to Tinkercad. And C, well, it's just easier for people to learn. Now, once you've learned it, you can go ahead and move on to a more expensive CAD program. But my take is, you know, why get a really, really nice CAD suite if all you're going to do is make boxes?
Yeah.
That's just, you know.
Yeah, if you're doing simple stuff. Like, yeah. I made a shower hook in
TinkerCAD. Shower hooks are good.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and take him through a couple of tips that people need if they're going to be doing 3D projects. The first thing that you're going to want, and this is something I kind of learned later in the game than I should have learned, is you need yourself a good digital caliper. This is absolutely essential if you're going to be designing objects into which other objects will fit, because this will give you a real accurate view of exactly what you have to create. Now, I said a good digital caliper because this is not a good digital caliper. This is a hella bad digital caliper. Now, if you go to the overhead, Burke, here's the problem when you're buying these. This is a great digital caliper. This is a horrible digital caliper. Problem is they look like really alike. Hey, look at this, Patrick. Yeah. Can you tell the difference? This one's yellow.
Yeah. It's closed.
They're both
pretty close to me. This one is a thing, so this must be better. This thing's sticking out the end.
Well, no, because I can make that thing.
Oh, that's
look,
just okay.
See? There you go. Now they have the little thingy thing.
Yeah, they look about the same.
They do, and this is the problem, because you go into Amazon and you say, oh, they all look the same. Except this is a $9 one and this is a $40 one. This one worked fine. Actually, I've had this on the show before. This was okay until about 6 months in, and it started giving me inaccurate measurements. And if it's going to give you inaccurate measurements, it's junk. It's absolute junk. It wastes so much time. That one is a $40 one. And when I first saw it, I'm like, who's going to buy a $40 one when I can buy a $9 one? Well, the reason is because I would end up buying 10 of these before that one goes too bad. This one is hyper, hyper accurate. This one, it's never given me a wrong measurement. And what you typically see on the bad ones is they'll work properly until, actually, let's see if I can, the battery on this is dead. Yeah, that's how much I care about it. This one worked perfectly until, like, I would start moving this like this, and then it would start jumping 10 millimeters at a time.
Oh.
And I'd have to close it up and try it again. So there's something wrong with the mechanism, the mechanical workings of this caliper that just made it junk. Now, this one, I've been using this for about 6 months as well, and it works as good the first day as it does today. Yeah. So get one of these. We've got a link there, if you go ahead and jump over. This is the one I would suggest right now. I know it's $40. I know you're thinking that's way more than I want to pay. But if you're going to be doing any sort of 3D design, that's an incredibly important tool to have. Now, also, make sure that you get yourself a couple of spare batteries. Now, luckily, this one comes with a spare battery. But you're going to be using these because almost all of these, they don't turn off unless you actually turn them off.
And you'll forget. Yeah.
So just leave one of those in the case. That's why that's in there. The other thing is, if you're going to get one of these are... okay.
I have a big
what
nose.
Did you just say about things having
I didn't
to go
put
into
it,
my body?
I didn't put it in. It's not in. I'm just...
Oh, he's calipering his nose. All right. So if you do get one of these, keep the case and just get used to the fact... there you go. Get used to the fact that if you're going to be using one of these, if you're not actually using it, it goes right back in the case. This is a precision instrument. It does not like to get bumped around. It does not like to be left in a tool drawer. It does not like to be dropped on the floor. So keep it in the case if you're not using it. Otherwise, you've just busted your $40 investment.
With the spare battery, because you'll lose that too, you'll never find it again.
You know, it's amazing how many of those CR2032 batteries I've bought. Because every time I buy, I'm like, oh, you know, one costs as much as 10, so I'll buy 10. And I use one, and then I have no idea where the 9 went. It just...
Yeah.
I thought I put them in a box, and they're gone.
Yeah, I have the same problem.
Yeah. I at some point, I'm going to move out of that lab and find, like, 5,000 CR2032 batteries.
I think they've all ended up at the back of my desk drawer, as they just got pushed back.
I think they might actually be in the same place as the socks I lose in my dryer.
I did find one in my washing machine.
That's probably not going to work.
I think it came out of my pocket.
What's the shelf life on those, by the way? I mean, it's got to be, it's a lithium coin battery. It should basically last forever. The discharge is negligible.
Yeah, well, you'll lose it before it just dies on its own.
Yeah. So actually, here's what you want to do. Before you go to DEF CON next year, buy like 100 CR2032 batteries and just give them out. It's goodwill. It's better than losing
them. This could be like business cards. You put your name and everything.
Actually, that's a really good idea. Here's a little charge for you. I'm stealing that. Okay. No, that's actually, Patrick, that's really, really good. All right, so tools. That's a tool that you want to get. The other thing that you want to know is techniques. This is going to help. If you go and switch over to my computer here, Burke, this is Tinkercad. There you go. This is Tinkercad. Now, I have done something. I've created a bunch of templates. And the reason why I've created templates is because it allows me to automatically drop into any project some of the most used devices that I use in my projects. So I've got a template for that LCD screen. I've got a template for the OLED screen. I've got a template for Arduinos, both the Nano and the Uno. What this allows me to do is instead of having to remeasure every single time I'm creating it, I go, oh, I want an Uno? Drop that in. Yeah. I want an IR sensor? Drop that in. I want a gas sensor? Drop that in. That's one of those little shortcuts that you're going to be able to develop once you get a little bit better with Tinkercad. So if you come back over to my computer, let's go to this. So this is actually a template that I made for an RTC, for a real-time clock. This allows me to take it and secure it via those two screws. This is the perfect height, the perfect shape, and the perfect width so that it perfectly holds the RTC without allowing any of the contact points to contact anything else. I can take this template and then just drop it into, say, the LED clock, or into my my light sensor, or into the Groduino. That's why I like doing the template style, because it means that in the future, I will never have to design this again. But let's take a look at how we actually design this and look at some of the things that you're going to want to know. First thing is, you're going to find a lot of times that you create something like this, which is the perfect size, and you want to go ahead and use it someplace else. Now, you could either grab this and create a new box and reshape it to the perfect size and height, but that's not so bueno. What you actually want to do is you just want to be able to Control-C and Control-V. Control-C, V. And I've just made myself another object exactly like that. So it's just like a word processor. However, there is a better key to use here, because when I do that, it actually offsets the shape a tiny bit so that I have the ability to know where it is. Otherwise, it would just drop it in, right where the current object is. There's a key called Control-C, Control-D. And what I've just done is I've dropped it exactly in place. And this is I use this a lot because it allows me to keep it in line with the existing object. So, for example,
and you're hitting the arrow keys to move it.
Precisely. Yeah. And this is another thing. In Tinkercad, I can use my arrow key. So rather than, because if I try to drag it, there's a good chance that, see how I get it offline.
Yeah,
now it's ruined. Precisely. Don't do that. Just use the arrow keys, and I can go back and forth, up and down as I want.
Very precise.
Another good key to know is if I hold down Control and hit up or down, it actually raises or lowers. And every time I hit the key, it's going to raise or lower or move according to the unit that I'm currently set to. And I don't know if you can zoom in on this, Burke, but right down here, I actually, on the snap grid, these are all the units that I'm operating in. So the default is 1 millimeter, but I could also be 0.1 millimeter, 0.25 millimeters, 0.5 millimeters, all the way up to 5 millimeters. So you choose what unit it's going to snap to. So if I put 5 millimeter and I start hitting this, it moves 5 whole units. Now, there's another key that you should probably know, and that is shift. Shift means move 10 units at a time. So I have it set for 1 millimeter. If I hold down shift and I hit an arrow key, that's 10 units. 10 millimeters. But if it was set for, say, 0.1 millimeter units, I hit shift and hold, what's going to happen is it's going to move one millimeter. Precisely. Also, Burke, if you go back, if I hold shift control, it's going to move up and down by 10 units at a time. So you can combine these. There is one other very useful tool here. If you were normally going to raise or lower this, what you would do is you would click this little the arrow, and then you can raise and lower, and hopefully you get it right there or so. Oh, I went under. Yeah, don't do that. If you click the object and hit D, it means drop it to the plate.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
It comes in really, really handy. And the reason why that comes in handy is what I will do sometimes is when I'm working on complex objects, I will take part of it and I will lift it up 20 units and work on it so that I'm not interfering with anything else in the design. Once I have it exactly the way I want it.
Drop it.
Drop it. Drop it to
drop
the floor.
Drop it like it's hot.
Drop it like it's 3D designed. Okay, here's another couple of pieces that you should know. You can do this. So these are individual parts. And if I change anything here, I'm going to have to reshape the entire object to account for that. I don't have to do this. If once I have this design locked in, I can actually highlight everything that's locked in. And this tiny little button up right here that says group, when I hit group, what it will do is it will do all the processing. This is now a single object. Nice. This is how you do complicated design in Tinkercad. You group together all the component pieces and then move them into place.
And now when you have multiple pieces and you want to move that red piece you had there, you only have to select that. You don't have to select all the individual parts that made up that piece.
Precisely. Precisely. Now let's go ahead and move on to a different... here's a design that I did for the buttons, the buttons that I like to use. So this is my template for when I want to make a button enclosure. So I could just take this and drag it and drop it into whatever project. This is a template I made for the IR motion sensors that I use. So it fits exactly into here. This is a template that I made for a gas sensor. And again, the sensor fits in, and then that fits onto the top of the sensor. This is a template that I made for the little OLED screens that I really like to use. And this one right here, this is a template for an Arduino Nano. So here's what they actually look like in real life. Burke, if you go ahead and go to the side view here, let's dump these out. So these are actual pieces of gear inside these templates. So that's an IR sensor. Here's an Arduino Nano. This is the motion sensor. This is the gas sensor. So these are all pre-designed. If I want to do anything with any of these pieces, I don't have to design that part of the enclosure. I just drop this in.
Yeah, wow. It's good to... Whoop, I broke it already.
No, that's supposed to fall out.
This will save so much time when you're using the same component in multiple things. You only have to design it once.
Yeah, and you're going to really quickly figure out which components you use most often because, well, you're going to use them the most often.
Yeah.
Go figure. That's kind of weird. One last little trick that you're going to want to know here. Let's go to a design I have that has a lot of stuff. So how about to the LED clock? So the LED clock has a lot of, well, just stuff. There's a whole lot of stuff. And it's a big, big design. So let's open this up. It's going to take a look. Now, if you wanted to start working on this, like let's say I wanted to work on just this little, those little nubs that keep the plates, it's kind of, it's at the wrong angle and I'm at the wrong magnification. It's not cool. I actually have a feature here, Patrick. I could click this. And then click this button right here. This is the fit view to selection. What it will do is it will zoom in on just that.
Oh.
And it allows me to really work on fine detail. And then when I'm done, I can click back out to home and get back out to the entire design. Just get used to this. Get used to being able to click what you want and then zoom into it.
You have no idea how much time I've wasted
zooming
in on the wrong thing and trying to...
Well, because you keep tumbling the object. Yeah. Ah, dang it, I need to work on... Ah.
No, zoom in here, rotate from this point. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, actually, let's do one more little hint here. Burke, if you come back to my computer, so let me just zoom back out. On a more complicated design like this, every once in a while, like there are design elements inside of this channel that I can't get to. What I can actually do is I can click that and do this, hide. And what it will do is it gets rid of it, but it's not deleted. It's still there. It's still in the design.
It's invisible.
It's just hidden. Right. So this allows me to see inside of solid objects. That, you know, they've added that. So when we first started with Tinkercad last year, they didn't have any of this. And it was they listened to their users, and their users said, look, we need to be able to work on individual fine pieces. We need to be able to get inside of the objects that we're creating. And so they added all these tools. And with this... I mean, we've made some pretty spectacular stuff using what is admittedly a low-end CAD program.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So that does it. Now, we're going to be getting more into 3D because we've got a new 3D printer coming in. I know you're having a problem with your Monoprice.
I am.
Yeah. But yeah,
we'll get that sorted out.
I have somehow. The same one, and it's working great.
Mine's the plus.
I'll take a look at it.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. When we come back, Patrick, you're going to help someone with
their DVR.
We're going to be all TiVo up in here.
Time to watch some TV.
Yeah. But before we do that, let's go ahead and take another sponsor of Know How. Now, we know that you love your gear. We know that you love all your tech and your toys, but it's too easy to lose. What if I told you that there was an easy way to track all of your most prized possessions? Well, folks, there is. It's called Tracker. Now, this episode of Know How is brought to you by this coin-sized device that makes sure that you always know where all your most prized possessions are. Now, there's a ritual to looking for, say, your keys. You know it. First, you check the obvious places, you know, couch, kitchen, pockets. Then the weird places, the bathroom, the fridge, the hamper. Then you start getting creative, like inside the mayo jar. It's always in the last place you look, and it's always in a strange, weird place that you can't imagine how it got there in the first place. Well, folks, with the tracker, you're not going to go through that anymore because you can go exactly to where you left your keys or your phone or your wallet or your watch. Now, 8 years ago, Tracker changed everything when they released their first tracking device. And now they've done it again with the all-new Tracker Pixel. With Tracker Pixel, you'll never worry about losing your things again. Tracker Pixel is the lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market. You just place Tracker Pixel on whatever you tend to lose, be it your keys, your wallets, even your cat, and it's small enough to fit on your smallest items. When you misplace an item that has a Tracker Pixel attached, you can use your smartphone and a 90-decibel alert to find it in seconds. It even has a powerful LED light, so you can find your items in the dark. Now, if you lose your phone, get this, it works in reverse. If you can find one of your trackers, you just press the button on your Tracker Pixel, and your phone will ring, even if it's on silent. You can even locate your item if it's miles away, because every tracker user is part of the largest crowd locate network in the world. As long as your tracker is in range of another tracker user, you still get a notification. And Tracker's 30 days money back guarantee means that you truly have nothing to lose. Folks, if you are tired of losing your gear, if you're tired of your phone wandering away, you owe it to yourself to try a tracker. Visit thetracker.com/knowhow right now for 20% off. Again, The Tracker, thetracker.com/knowhow for 20% off. And we thank The Tracker for their support of Know How. All right, Patrick, so hit me. We've got a TiVo problem from Rudd Dog, a longtime member of Arquitas.
Yeah, my TiVo's slowly starting to die. Looking at replacing this with something capable of carrying out my DVR needs, the TiVo is my local and Comcast reporting go-to box. It is simple and no learning curve. HD Home Run Prime is the only device found during my search allowing the use of my Comcast descrambler card and DVR, although they charge $35 a year for the program listing service. Oh, and the DVRs are sent to your local NAS. Any recommendations for the hardware replacement TiVo carrying out the same duties as the TiVo?
Yeah. The funny thing is, this is one of those problems time immemorial, because people were having issues with this 15, 20 years ago when they were trying to create their own. The cable companies have made it so difficult for you to use their service. Even though it's mandated that they can let you rent one of those cable cards, they don't have to give you the program listing and they don't have to make it easy. And I feel your pain, Red Dog.
And I have a TiVo Premiere. I think it's a Premiere XL. I forget which one. But I've been using that for nearly 10 years now, and it's been reliable. But because they're always on the hard drives, they have trouble. Especially if it's a dusty environment, they can just die on you. And so if you're having trouble, it's probably the hard drive. And so fortunately,
the solution is to buy a new TiVo, right? Just go ahead and just shell out a couple hundred bucks.
Well, you could. I mean, if you want to upgrade the TiVo, if you want the 4 or 6 receivers...
Don't do that.
You could.
No.
But you'd have to buy a new lifetime plan.
Oh.
Because always do the lifetime plan. Mine's lasted 10 years. I paid lifetime once. Never have to do monthly fee. That was a good deal for me. But you don't want to have to, because it's lifetime of the device. So the best thing to do is replace the hard drive or repair it. You could try taking it out and plug it into a PC and have run SpinRite on that.
SpinRite does actually work quite well. One thing, however, is that if you're using SpinRite on a drive, that's sort of a temporary measure. That's an emergency recovery. Even Steve Gibson himself will say, once you get it working, copy everything off and go. Can I do that with a TiVo? Can I, like, sector by sector copy to a new drive?
You can.
Okay.
People have replaced their... it's fairly common to take your hard drive out, repair it if you need to, and then you can copy it to a new larger drive, and then you've got even more storage. You just want to make sure it's partitioned correctly so that you have the full space.
Yeah, and there's plenty of tutorials. In fact, you know, we should probably do a know-how on that at some point. We'll just take a TiVo and clone the drive. I wonder, could I use an SSD? There's probably no advantage to using an SSD. It's not like it's really going to help you see faster.
Yeah, it doesn't need to record faster.
I mean, you get the reliability. I guess. I don't know. No. All right. So there's fix the drive and copy over to a new drive. Of course, there's buying a new TiVo, right? But then, like you said, I have to rebuy everything I bought.
But you could invest in the future. The TiVo Bolt gets 4 or 6 shows can be recorded at once, and it is also 4K. So if you're going to be making that jump, if you think you're going to do that, that's a possibility. You might as well upgrade. But that is $200 to $500. And then if you get the lifetime, that's another $550. Mm. So you're looking at $750 to $1,000 for that. I mean, it could last 10 years or, you know.
Now, what's wrong with me just going to Comcast and saying, well, Comcast offers a DVR. Why don't I just use their DVR?
Their DVR is terrible. Wow. Have you used it?
I have, and that's why I don't use it anymore.
It's so laggy. And I've gone to people's houses, and they have this, and they're trying to select things, and it takes so long just to watch a show and to get through the menus. And I love my TiVo because I just hit the button, menu comes up, and under a second, I can go to the guide, go down, and select a channel, and it's quick. Yeah. I mean, the UI could be better. It's not like it's designed by Apple, which I wish Apple bought this like 10 years ago. They should have bought TiVo and taken over. But... the TiVo interface, I love it so much more than the cable provider ones.
Yeah.
Time Warner, Comcast.
I will say there is another option. If you're stuck into Comcast, the HD Home Run actually does work well. It's a network-connected device that you plug in the cable card into, and then it has Ethernet on the other side. So you have the ability to output. Now, here's the fun part, and I do want to do an episode on this, but I have to get a couple of HD Home Runs first. You can use a Synology NAS. It actually has a plug-in that will accept input from multiple HD Home Runs, and it becomes your DVR. And the cool thing about that is they're just files, so you can media serve them out just like you would if they were AVIs or WMVs or MP4s. That's an awesome way to build up a local cache of content, but one thing that Rudd Dog mentioned is... he kind of likes having the program guide, and that's not going to come along with it. Yeah, Comcast is not going to give that up because they know that's the last piece. Once they give you that, an easy way to get it, there's no reason for you to buy their super laggy, super expensive DVR.
Yeah. Well, at least I can get the program guide through TiVo with that lifetime service.
So, Rudd Dog, I guess what we're saying is you can fix your TiVo, but other than that, you owe everything to Comcast. Sorry.
Yeah.
Folks, we know that this has been a lot of information, as is typical with our feedback episodes. We want to make it easy for you to get the links to any of the products that we've talked about or the knowledge that we've dropped on you. You can find that at our show notes. And Patrick, I think we have that at twit.tv/KH. There, not only will you find our back episodes and our show notes, but also, very importantly, where to subscribe. If you want to support Know How, if you want to keep seeing these DIY and maker shows, if you want to see Patrick back on the show, because otherwise we have to kill him, just go here and select your version of choice, be it audio, video, or high definition video.
HD.
I mean, and drop it into your device of choice.
Don't take video low. Really, it's not good.
It's not good
at all. Low quality video that's left over from like 10 years ago.
So. Also,
HD.
Don't forget that you can find us on the socials, specifically on Google+. Just go to Google+, look for Know How. There's a very short approval process so I can keep out the spam accounts. But once you're in, you get access to almost 11,000 Kitas. Or 12,000. Almost 12,000 Kitas. That's our know-it-alls. These are the fans of the show, the experts along every space of the maker continuum, people who you can get ideas from or maybe you can answer questions for. It's all part of being a maker. Again, just go to Google+ and look for Know How. Also, don't forget that you can find us on the Twitters. That's a really good spot to find out what we're doing when we're not here on the set. You can find me at twitter.com/PadreSJ.
And I'm at twitter.com/pdelahanty.
And you can find our TD today, Burke, at twitter.com/anelf3. Just go there. And
he will tell you where to find Burke.
Exactly. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Balasair.
And I'm Patrick Delahanty.
And now that you know how,
go ask us more questions.